Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Welcome, everyone, to another beautiful episode of Cooking in Mexican from A to Z on the beautiful Heritage Radio Network, and alongside my beautiful mom,
Sarela Martinez,
and Amaron Sanchez, and today we have the unbelievable pleasure of inviting to talk with us and chat about all things Southwestern cuisine. I consider him my tío. He's one of the founding fathers of this beautiful Southwestern cuisine movement that started many moons ago. And of course, we're talking about the incomparable, the brilliant, super uber talented Chef Stephen Piles. I consider him my tío, my uncle. And just to give you guys a little bit of a background, of course, he's the chef, cookbook author, philanthropist, and educator. And Chef Piles, he's one of the founding fathers of Southwestern cuisine, you can imagine. So over 23 restaurants in six cities in the past 30 years or so. And, you know, he's put a lot of really important restaurants on the map and opened up the world to the beautiful combination of how the Southwest interacts and kind of has roots in Mexico. And, of course, he's Emmy winning award for his PBS TV series. I mean, James Beard Award winner for Best Chef. I mean, I can keep going on and on and on. But I want everyone to please welcome and somebody that I care and I admire very much, Chef Stephen Piles.
Thank you, Aron and Zarella, for having me today. You flatter me and embarrass me, but mostly flatter me. Keep
exactly,
going.
Yeah,
keep going. I'm thrilled
Stephen
to be
and
here.
I have been friends since 1987. You know, he and I discovered Oaxaca together. We went on this trip, and we went to Chiapas. And so we recently went on another trip to Oaxaca, and it was so interesting to catch up and to compare the first trip, but our friendship was the same and even stronger. So it was just a beautiful time.
It was spectacular. And, you know, we did see some change there, but it was only in, I think, the quality of the restaurants, which, to be honest, was a little surprising. I mean, there was a couple of restaurants, well, one in particular, you know, you could have been anywhere in the world. I was like, wow, this is in Oaxaca? So it's pretty exciting. And but you started at Zarella. You gave me my push into Oaxaca, and I can never think of Oaxaca without thinking of you.
Thank you.
And your
you
glory.
Know, one of the things that we didn't talk about is that in the introduction is how you're like the founder of Texas Southwestern food.
Well, I call it it's called two different things. As it sort of evolved, it's called different things. One thing is certainly Southwestern cuisine. But I started calling my cuisine Modern Texas some years ago. So I feel like I'm one of the founding fathers of Southwestern cuisine, but kind of the founding father of Modern Texas, just because it's very different than Southwestern today. So many more cultural
influences. And I agree.
And
I think also, Chef, you have been so renowned for your presentation and your detail to all the small factors that make something so important that makes it actually bigger. I just think you have such an art for dressing plates and letting them sing visually and, of course, backed up by flavor. But let's talk a little bit about that. I think it's important for people that are listening to understand what are those differences, what distinguishes something Southwestern to New Texan, all those good things.
Well, that's a good question. You know, I think when we first started playing around with, and we didn't name it Southwestern, the press did. We just were doing something that was regional. There was a group of chefs, Dean Faring, myself, Mark Miller, Robert Del Grande, and we were all kind of French trained or classically trained, and then we kind of discovered the ingredients and culture and roots of our regions. And I have, of that group, am the only Texan. I'm a fifth generation Texan. So I've always really thought of it more as Texas than Southwestern. Southwestern originally, you know, was incorporated so much of the Native American influence and primarily Mexican and certainly a little bit of the Southern, but Texas cuisine in specific, there's so much a wider range, I think, just so many disparate cultures. Certainly Southern is a big, big part. Fried chicken, peach cobbler, you know, foods from Africa. But there's also a side of it that doesn't necessarily exist in Southwestern, and that sort of cowboy range cooking, you know, open fire cooking. And so that really says Texas to me. And of course, I couldn't do it without chilies and all the major influences from Mexico. So, and there's even a little bit of I know you're big on New Orleans now, Aaron, and there's a bit of a, you know, in Port Arthur in that part of the state, there's a Cajun Creole influence. That's not typical in Southwestern as well.
I think it's very important to delineate because I think, you know, what Chef Mark Miller has done in New Mexico, I think I'm happy that you're making that distinction, Chef, because I think it's important. Right, Mom? To understand the differences between that.
I remember when this whole movement started, I think John Sedler was a big force in this. And he had this idea of salsa and chips was a big blue plate with a chip cut in the form of a star. And then this squiggle light of a salsa. That was his idea of chips and salsa. And huevos a la mexicana or huevos rancheros was a soft-boiled egg with salsa inside and in this beautiful little container. So that was taking it a little bit too much.
Yeah. Well, remember John also did the rattlesnake of caviar, and it was you know, all the typical accoutrement for caviar, the egg and the salad. But it was all, I mean, we decided that had to take 3 hours just to do one order. I mean, it was like art. It was art, and it tasted pretty good. But yeah, I agree. We sometime got a little carried away. Oh, you know, and I did this tamale book with Mark Miller and John Sedler, and I always thought of mine, I was kind of in the middle. You had Mark Miller, who was a lot more rustic and down to earth, you know, and then you had John Sedler up here, who were kind of always trying to bring back down to earth. It was like three different versions.
Who did the pheasant under glass?
That was John, of course.
Of course.
He also did the gold tamale, don't leave home without it.
and what was that?
I don't even remember.
But it sounds awesome.
I just remember the name.
Well, I remember that one of my customers went to check it out for me because he was getting a lot of press, John's. And she came back and asked how it was. She says, well, you know, it's all right. Blue tacos and all.
blue tacos.
Well, I think, Zarella, I think that's where we first saw each other. I think that's where we first laid eyes on each other. We were going to a conference together with Michael McCarty out at Lowry's in Los Angeles, the first ever, probably, conference on Southwestern cuisine. And I had certainly heard of you and couldn't wait to meet you. But we saw each other at, what was the name of it? Saint Estef, and I looked across and we kind of waved and we talked afterwards. But that's where we first met at John Sedler's.
I know, you were so supportive of me because I was literally just starting.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also your mother was there, and you two scared the hell out of me on Santa Monica Boulevard.
Hi.
You were driving, and she was in the front seat, and I was in the back seat with my hands over my eyes.
That sounds about right.
And she was
and they're just going at it. They're just going at it like this. Don't turn here. That's stupid. Stop it. Stop it. And I'm going, God, please just get me back to the hotel.
And she would swerve like out of the way of another car. And she'd say, my reflexes are still so good, honey.
But I, you know what? And I think that's beautiful that everyone needs to know that's listening is that you and my mom, Chef, And many others, Chef Papadom, all the American regional cuisine started to be born at that point. And I think that's really very impressive because you guys followed the Nouvelle Cuisine inflection, invasion between Michel Richard, Jean-Louis Paladin, and then all of a sudden this beautiful American regional cuisine is born.
Yeah, it really all happened between 81 and 83 or 84. I mean, so many restaurants. And what was happening, if we're honest, is that we were doing French Nouvelle cuisine, but with American ingredients. Mm. And then it just sort of finally became a little more Americanized and more rustic and more cultural. And then it became New American cuisine. But we all sort of took our cues from the French Nouvelle folks at that day.
Except that, you know, like the Mexican food was all based on Tex-Mex, you know, at that point where I came on.
That's exactly
and
right.
My mom and I came in and started doing regional Mexican food at that first big event that we did at Tavern on the Green. And people didn't know what hit them. You know, we were doing things with tomatillos, like crab enchiladas with tomatillos and making it, you know, like more traditional.
And it's no more obvious and specific than in Texas, and I think Dallas in particular, you know, because we are so entrenched in Tex-Mex and what Mexican means to us. And when a really great Mexican restaurant opens, they don't stay open long because people, you know, why would I pay that much? And this is not Mexican. It's, you know, and so finally, just now, some really good Mexican restaurants have opened and are having some good success.
Yeah, like what? Which ones?
Well, Jose is Anastasia, we call her AQ, Quiñones, and she's been at several restaurants around. One was Alma, but they just don't stay open for more than about a year. So that's a great one right now. And Tulum is another one. There was a chef from Tulum that spent time in some Michelin restaurants. And, you know, that was the interesting thing about Oaxaca, don't you think, was that these Mexican chefs have traveled the world and come back home. You know, they've spent time in Michelin restaurants. They've got this technique, but they embrace those wonderful Mexican ingredients in it. So it's a whole new style.
Well, you should see this guy, this meal that we had, honey, at this place called El Destilado. And they're distilling different spirits and stuff like that. But it was supposed to be a 6-course tasting menu, but it ended up being the 10-course because they were so thrilled that we were there that they sent us everything. And it was mind blowing. I mean, it was absolutely mind blowing. And the guy had never been out of Mexico. Yeah.
Well, he hadn't, but he worked with Julio, I think it was, and he had worked at Cezanne in San Francisco, which is one of my favorite restaurants in the country. So it really you could tell that was the infusion there, that was the influence. In fact, Zarella, they wanted us there, they liked having us there so much that they charged us 10 times the check. Remember?
Yeah.
Instead of 2,100, it was 21,000. We got home.
Yeah, said, you and your big mouse, you know. You know, I love it. But that's, and first of all, Tio, Chef, I'm so happy that you were with my mom on this last trip to Oaxaca. Thank you so much. Because, you know, I take a lot of pride in taking care of my mama, obviously.
And I want to make sure that she's well. Always, you do it
I'm
well.
I'm trying my best. Wrong. I can always do better. But I think it's important to mention that you just said something interesting about the fact that Mexican chefs are starting to be influenced by so many different places. And not only, yes, French technique, but also what's happening close to them. Just came back from Tlaxcala, which is the smallest state in Mexico. That's the home of the Malinche. They call it La Cuna de Tortilla y Maíz. And one of the things that I was fascinated about, and I want to hear you guys both opinion, is the idea of the cocinera tradicional. So a woman or a man that cooks in a local area, but it's not professionally trained. Now they're starting to get this beautiful sort of recognition. I think it's a very interesting time about that. And I would like to know how that refers a little bit back to what we're talking about as far as, was there a home cook in your little region, in your hometown, Stephen, that was like the grand dame or the grand dude that cooked food that taught you?
Yeah, my mother.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
You know, I was raised in a truck stop cafe.
Yeah, yeah.
So my dad did, you know, it was really kind of fry cook and Mexican food, but we did barbecue and fried chicken and that sort of thing. But my mother was the pastry chef. So, and pastry chef meant, you know, coconut cake and peach cobbler and
lemon
and
meringue,
lemon meringue pie and chocolate ice box pie. So yeah. And my grandmother was a great cook. And, so it was all family. I think probably in the restaurants, and there weren't chefs back then. We didn't call them chefs, we called them fry cooks.
Yeah.
But they were all men. Yeah. But at home, it was always the women cooking. Zarella, remember that meal we had? Oh, now I've forgotten the name. De olla.
Levadura de olla. That was
yeah.
That was a
bit along the lines of what Aaron is talking about.
But there, it's called the cocina de humo. It's a smoke, yeah, because everything is done with wood and a very big comal, which is anchored, you know, with cement, and then a fire. And it was this amazing food. You know, we had the tasting menu the night before and then this other menu the next day. And it blew your mind. And you didn't realize until the end that it was all vegetarian.
Yeah.
And it was, including the tamal, when it was this, there were probably 10 dishes or 12 dishes. I don't know how many.
And there were all women in the kitchen. There were no men in the kitchen.
Love that.
And it was really replicated from the, where was it from, Zarella?
From this little town called something like Yankisu or something like that.
Yeah. Small, tiny little town. But they'd brought the women in from there to cook. It was really spectacular. And I don't remember that before either when I was in Oaxaca, that style. So.
And so do you find, Chef Steven, now that younger people are gravitating to the idea of what new Texan cuisine could be and understanding that this is going to be a sort of an inspirational place that they can sort of find their way, or no?
I think so, Aaron. Here's the deal. You know, as is any typical evolution, I think, of food, but there doesn't seem to be, it's what the important food that's happening with the younger chefs right now in Dallas, certainly in Texas, it's more worldly, it's more global, and they're embracing the idea of local. And so they're using chilies and they're using black beans and Texas game, but I wouldn't necessarily call it modern Texas. I mean, that exists, and those places are very popular, but it's interesting to see the evolution, and I'm not sure what you call it. It's not really modern Texas. It's just kind of modern with the Texas influence, if that makes sense. So there's a lot happening.
Who else? Who's sort of like a hot new chef in that field?
Well, not necessarily in that field, but I think the best restaurant currently in Dallas is a place called Meridian.
Yes,
and it is, do you know Junior?
Yeah, I've heard about
Junior
Borges.
Yeah.
Oh.
And Junior, spectacular. And what he's done, which is really unique, he's Brazilian, and he's incredibly skilled and with modern cuisine. And so it's like his version of what Brazilian food could be. And so that's an example of what I was saying earlier. Certainly there's some Texas influence in there because he's in Texas, but Matt McAllister's doing a great job at Homewood. He's Dean's old chef, Eric Dreyer, is now at a place called Monarch. Danny Grant, I think, the two-star Michelin chef out of Chicago, opened Monarch in a building downtown, and that's very popular. So there's some stuff going on here finally.
Well, because the thing is that, you know, Tex-Mex influence is so strong that it doesn't allow the regional Mexican cuisine to grow, I think, in many parts of Texas.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. We're seeing some change there, thank God. But it's taken 20, 30 years.
So, Mom, but remember when Mema explained the difference between Tex-Mex versus Mexican, right?
No, remind me.
Well, I remember having this conversation. She said basically it was when Mexico and the border was porous. Texas ranchers or cowboys would come and work in Mexico. They liked aspects of the food. Maybe some of it was a little spicier than other. And then to your point, Chef Stephen, as far as like the open air cooking, and they started using flour tortillas instead of corn and green chilies that were milder. And these sort of things started happening, no? You know, and so this sort of beautiful new sort of style of Mexican cuisine was born, or Tex-Mex was born. Yeah. Kind of thing, no?
That's great. And I was always asked early on what the difference between Southwestern and Tex-Mex was. And my answer was much simpler. $15.
Exactly. And thank Chef Mark for that. And that's why I work for him, so I know.
That's so hilarious. You know, when I first came on the scene, the photos, I repeat this, but maybe not here yet. The photos of that year in 1983 said the Mexican food that's available in the United States bears the same uncomfortable resemblance that a howling monkey has to man.
Wow.
A lot's changed.
Who said that?
It wasn't the Photo's Guide.
Oh, photo. Okay.
But a lot's changed, though.
That's
the point.
Pretty, pretty brilliant.
Well, I recently got a call for somebody that's doing a book on burritos, and they wanted to tell me that it was invented in El Paso. I said, I don't think so. You know, burritos as a cowboy, it's a cowboy thing that was their sandwich that they would take on their saddlebag, you know, to eat for lunch.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But it is a Texas invention.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the biggest difference is that the burritos where we're from don't have any cheese or rice. It's just the meat, the chile corrado, and the flour tortilla wrapped. It's not necessarily all that other accoutrement and all that, no?
The chorizo with egg. When I was a social worker, there was for breakfast around 9 o'clock, the women would come in with a little basket of burritos to sell, either beans with cheese and jalapeno, or chorizo with egg. It was so good, but it was just like a snack. It wasn't like this gross thing that they give you now.
Mm-hmm. And I can't imagine Tex-Mex without. And we talked about this, the cheese. I mean, everything has 12 layers of cheese.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the combination plates.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I remember when I had that big contract for GTE that we had to feed, I think, 3,000 people. They had this party one time, and we had to do combination plates for everybody. So you just imagine a home cook making a combination plate, enchilada, chile relleno, carne tan picaña, everything. At the end, we were making the chile rellenos and sticking our hands in the boiling fat and putting on and not feeling anything.
Exactly.
A chef is born.
Exactly. You can thank San Antonio for that, I think, in a lot of ways. I think every time I've been to San Antonio, it's always been this place where it has tons of combo platters, you know what I mean? Yeah. And a lot of cheese, which is nothing wrong if that's your bag, but you know what I mean? I just think.
Well, I remember when I opened the little taqueria in Las Vegas. It's still there, called Canyonita, but I'd spent so much time in Mexico City at the taquerias, and I wanted to do something, you know, as authentic as I could. And people would come in from Mexico City, and they would say, oh, this is so great. I haven't had this since I left Mexico City. Somebody would come in from San Antonio and say, this isn't Mexican.
Totally. You're like, really? I know. I mean, the puffy taco. Do I have to say more? Yeah. You know what I mean?
What did you have there? And what kind of stuff did you have in that menu?
We had, several kinds of tacos, but they were, you know, we made the masa there. And so it was typical, three different tacos that you might have, maybe with a little bit of innovation. I tried to do kind of the best of, you know, like you go to Mexico City and you find a place that does nothing but empanadas, one that does nothing but tamales, one that does nothing but tacos. So we did a little of each of those, but just kind of as on its own. We didn't want to have to. We ended up about 6 months later putting, you know, beans and rice with everything, which I didn't want to do, but you have to do it.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's, the pizza restaurant, is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. And of course, there's the 2-Michelin-starred Blanca tucked away in the garden for truly daring diners. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City and now in Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
But you know what was interesting about that place, the Cocina de Humo, is that I always say that tamales have to have lard. And so they served the tamales.
Oh, they didn't there. That's yeah, right. It was all about, vegetarian.
But it wasn't fluffy. It was just
no,
like...
No, you're right. It wasn't. It wasn't. It was. That was the one thing that was a little lacking. Mm. And that's why now we know why.
Exactly. Good home-rendered lard, right, Mom?
But God, the flavors were spot on otherwise.
Yeah. I love it.
And so what trends do you see coming?
Well, I'm sort of... out of that prediction, thank God, because I don't have to be.
You took your time, Chef.
You know, I think it will always be about local and organic and healthy and big flavors. And, you know, it's interesting just to see, we just continue to become more and more of a melting pot, and anything is, nothing is off limits in terms of combining cultures and a little from column A and a little from column B and but I'll tell you as it's represented in the growth in the U.S. All kinds of Latin and Hispanic cuisines are going nowhere, so that's going to proliferate. You know, it's just going to continue to be more and more important. Peruvian has, really kicked in now. So I think Latin America and Mexico, I mean, I think those are just huge influences in what's happening in America and will continue to be for decades.
Are food trucks a big deal in Dallas? Because they seem to be creating a lot of the trends now.
They are. We have this wonderful park downtown now called Clyde Warren, and it probably has 30 food trucks, and it's a big deal. Yeah, I think you know, it's interesting. They've been around for at least 15 years, maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know, but yeah. It seems like they're you know, it's past the trend test. Because they're still going and becoming stronger. So it's more than a trend. I think it's here to stay.
I hope people take the food truck and use it as an inspiration for a brick and mortar to open their own restaurant. You know, that hopefully that's the goal.
Yeah, and I think they're doing that.
And the Korean-Mexican combination, honey? The tacos?
Look, I think it's very interesting. If you ask me what is the food that I crave other than my own that are, you know, the Mexican, would be Korean, because it's redolent with chili and acid, and there's a lot of different accoutrements and pickles and all those different things to keep your palate engaged. And I think that's something I really enjoy. And I think, you know, I've got to spend time with Roy Choi, and I think he's doing a really good job at it. I'm not a fan of fusion. It creates confusion, but I think that's mm-hmm. one of the passes that you can have. I think there's some parallels there that make sense to me personally, but.
Well, I've always thought Asian in general and Mexican were just a, you know, I saw it in Houston. I mean, it's been there now. It's a whole generation, but you know, the Vietnamese boat people that, you know, they settled in several parts of the country in masses, like Minneapolis for one reason. Good Lord.
And New Orleans.
So cold.
In New Orleans.
In New Orleans, yeah. but in Houston is a big, yeah, big community, and it's just this wonderful amalgamation now of flavors and foods with that Vietnamese sort of Mexican, you know, sort of combination.
Yeah, chilies.
I don't know a lot about that Vietnamese, yes, combination.
Yes, Mom. Thanks for bringing that up. Appreciate it. You know how my mom is.
Insider information.
Mom, thanks,
here.
For, thanks for bringing that up. Awesome.
And you know what, Ron? I know what she's talking about.
Exactly.
I've known you long enough.
Exactly.
I think I've known you. I asked her when we were in Oaxaca. I think I've known you since you were 8.
Yep. I was a little.
Because that, whenever, however old you were when you first came to New York.
Yeah.
And your mother was told she was going to fall on her face, and she said, I'm going to make it if I sell burritos in Central Park.
And look at her. I tell everybody I did.
And look at her.
I just did a deal.
And now she's selling tamales there, too.
Exactly. Apparently. I tell people, I'm like, she's like the Mexican Tina Turner. She's like, I just want my kids, and I want my name. That's all I care about. You know what I mean? And she's done it. Look at her. And you have done that as well, Chef. I mean, you have no idea what a bright light you are, and you have elevated Tex-Mex flavors to the next level. You know, you have no idea. I remember going to your restaurant last time I was there, and you made this beautiful little sopa. It was like a sopa de ajo that had the Spanish influence, and I remember how beautifully presented it was. And your restaurant had this beautiful open kitchen, and just your commitment to our craft and to our industry is undeniable. And I just think you have been such a beautiful force of inspiration for me and so many others. So I just wanted to tell you that.
Well, since we're on that wagon, I will tell you that I have never been prouder of anybody than you to see, you know, where you came from and where you've ended up. You haven't ended up, you're still going, but where you are now. And it's just amazing. You know, and when I tell people about Zarella, and they say, yeah, I think I've heard, yeah, I know Zarella. And then I say, her son is Aaron Sanchez. Oh, yes, of course we know him. So.
And the same thing happened with my mom, because they say, isn't Zarella great? Yes, but have you met Aida?
You know? So you're right in the middle, Zarella.
tell everybody the story of your squash blossoms.
Oh, so I had this great house out in Oak Cliff, and Zarella and her mother came in for, I have these big July 4th parties every year, mostly for my staff. I had, you know, 120 staff and all their friends, and so we had these big parties, and so they came in the day before, and I had this really beautiful garden. I don't know, it was like a quarter of an acre or something, but I had, all the squash were in blossom. It was just this beautiful orange sort of
canopy.
And so I couldn't, you know, I thought, what great timing to have this party and this beautiful, all these beautiful blossoms. So we were trying to decide what to have dinner that night, and Aida had slipped out, and I didn't even know it, and she went to my garden and raped it. She took every squash blossom there that I was saving for, you know, this presentation of my party tomorrow, and made this, I must say, very delicious squash blossom soup. And
without checking with you, by the way, just, you know,
yeah, without checking,
she went rogue. Rogue.
Yeah. So it's, she's mentioned in my first book, and the recipe I credit her with.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's wonderful.
Well, the main entertainment of that party was this friend of Steven's who had a knockout body, and she would go in and change into different bathing suits every 15 minutes and parade all around.
That's very, very Dallas.
Yeah, very
Dallas. Yes.
And then her daughter started doing
this. But yeah, that's the funny thing. Her daughter would do the same thing by the time she was 10. Yeah. She was, we would see Clarissa would disappear, the daughter would disappear. They would both come out in different two-piece swimsuits.
I love it.
I'm happy they enjoyed their body. Are you still entertaining a lot or no?
Not that way. I'm doing dinner parties. I'll tell you, I have enjoyed cooking more in the last year since I've kind of semi-retired because I'm actually cooking in the kitchen. You know, I mean, before when you have all those chefs, you know, you don't really cook that much. You do a charitable dinner and the restaurant brings it over. So I'm actually, you know, in the kitchen cooking and it's a great fun. So I'm doing these fun dinner parties for, you know, 10, 12 people and, you know, seven courses. And so it's fun. Yeah, I'm having a lot of fun.
And one of the things that I want to do, and I was telling this because, you know, of my scholarship, and I'm just going to do a shameless plug for the Edwin Sanchez Scholarship Fund. But I think one of the things that is important for the kids to know is I think the culinary schools need to do a tree of all of American regional chefs and be able to see where all these wonderful chefs have come from. So imagine how many people have come from my mom's kitchen and your kitchen, Chef Steven, and all of this. So I think to give some nice perspective to see this beautiful family tree of chefs and how much influence you have imparted. And I think that's what something's important that needs to be.
I think it's a great idea. I like that.
Yeah.
And I've never seen that really. I've never seen that in curriculum.
That's a great idea, honey.
No, and it's true. It's because, like, you know, I mean, I work for Douglas Rodriguez. I work for Mark Miller and Paul Prudhomme. Think about all these beautiful chefs. And it's the same like in football. You know, these coaches have all these wonderful coaches that go on and do things that are great, right? So something should be created like that to pay further homage to you, Chef Steven, all your contributions and continued contributions and my mom and that paved the way for so many people.
Well, you know, I mean, just getting back to your scholarship program very fast, I was talking to somebody at that Levadura de Olla, the sous chef there, and I mentioned your scholarship, and she immediately ran and got a piece of paper and wrote, looked you up and said, I want to have my son apply, or her daughter, I guess, because it's all women there. So you're doing a beautiful job, honey, you know, with a scholarship program that you have, and I'm so proud of you. And I'm so happy that we were all together for a little while, because now the time...
This has been great. I can't thank you both enough. This is...
Thank you, Chef Steven.
It's been very special. You know how I love your mother, and I can't wait to... We should all go to Oaxaca.
Let's do it up. Well, we're going to have to, because I have to move her in there, so you're going to help me with that.
Oh, yeah. Okay, I'll help you. I will help you.
And I just wanted to remind everybody who's been our guest this beautiful podcast. We've been talking about Southwestern cuisine, and we kind of also defined, I think, what New Texan cuisine is all about. And, of course, we have the pioneer of that, my tío, somebody that is very important to our family, and, of course, one of my mom's best friends and colleagues, Chef Steven Powell. So thank you so much for being with us.
Cooking in Mexican from A to Z is powered by Simple Cast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without your support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like. Tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
everybody. I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.